Caroline Fredrickson. I'm the president of the American Constitution Society. Some of you may know us, also known as ACS. We are a national network of lawyers, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. We work for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. We're very pleased today to be able to join with the Administrative Conference, along with the American Bar Association and the Federalist Society, to consider the issues at the intersection of criminal and administrative law. We've been delighted to hear from a group of experts on this subject, many of whom ACS has had the privilege of working with over the years. As you've heard, there is obviously a differing opinion among various constituencies on how to respond to the increase in criminal penalties assigned to regulatory offenses and how agency enforcement of these regulations should occur. To further this dialogue, as today's symposium comes to a close and maybe wake you up at the end of the afternoon, we have with us Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who we work with closely at ACS and are very proud when we do. Senator Whitehouse has represented Rhode Island since 2007, having previously served as the state's Director of Business Regulation, U.S. Attorney, and Attorney General. Senator Whitehouse chairs the Environment and Public Works Subcommittee on Oversight and the Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism. He's a member of the Budget Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and the Special Committee on Aging. And so I think we should all be very grateful that Senator Whitehouse is with us today, because he's obviously a very busy man. Senator Whitehouse is a graduate of Yale University and the University of Virginia School of Law. So please join me in extending a warm round of applause for Senator Whitehouse.
Thank you, Caroline, and good afternoon, everyone. Nothing like several hours of discussion about regulatory law to stimulate a fellow, huh? I'm grateful to the Administrative Conference of the United States, to the Bar Association, to the Federalist Society, and to ACS for this important event. I have been an advocate in regulatory proceedings. That's how I started my career. I've been a regulator. I was my state's Director of Business Regulation. And I've been the U.S. Attorney and the Attorney General for my state. So criminal and regulatory law is an area of considerable interest to me. And let me open with a word of gratitude for regulation. Medicines are not snake oil mysteries any longer. People are rarely burned or killed in boiler explosions. Automobiles have airbags. Smokestacks have pollution controls. Stock jobbers have a harder time gulling innocent investors. Most insurance companies and policies actually pay when the insured hazard occurs. Quacks and barbers can't be doctors. We take for granted the safety and reliability that a regulated world has built. We also take for granted how regulation helps advance our economic progress. Regulation helps channel America's competitive enterprise into valuable, helpful innovations, instead of into new tricks and traps for consumers or new ways of cutting safety corners. Confidence in our industries grows when consumers know they can count on the safety and reliability of the product. Ask yourselves, would the American pharmaceutical industry be the world powerhouse that it is if patent medicine hucksters were still allowed to operate? Regulation sets a positive frame for economic progress. And where there are common goods we share, like clean streams and oceans or unpolluted skies, there is a perverse economic incentive to abuse the resource, leaving us all poorer. This is the principle described in Garrett Hardin's famous Tragedy of the Commons. Regulation constrains this perverse economic incentive and protects our precious common resources. Now, critics of regulation will often point out that regulations can be overbroad, out of date, ineffective, or unduly burdensome. Of course, error and obsolescence occur in any human endeavor. To maximize the economic benefit of regulation, we have to keep regulations efficient and up to date. But my experience is this. When the deregulatory crowd comes to operationalize this principle, the target is rarely some obsolete technical regulation that properly needs updating. The target is the Clean Air Act. The target is the ban on insurance companies denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. The target is regulations to keep Wall Street from trashing the economy again. Often when you pull back the curtain marked regulation can be obsolete and burdensome, there's a Rottweiler behind the curtain. On the other side of the coin, there is a threat at least as great as burdensome regulation, the threat of regulatory capture when powerful interests gain improper influence over regulatory agencies. Catastrophic consequences can unfold, as we've seen recently in the Minerals Management Service and the Gulf oil spill, in the Mine Health and Safety Administration and the Sago mine disaster, and in a suite of financial regulators and the recent global financial meltdown. In each of these cases, captured regulatory agencies overly beholden to the regulated industries failed to protect the American people. The problem of regulatory capture has been recognized for decades. Woodrow Wilson explained more than 100 years ago, I'll quote him, "If the government is to tell big businessmen how to run their business, then don't you see that big businessmen must capture the government in order not to be restrained too much by it?" Regulatory capture has been discussed in the research of Nobel laureate George Stigler, in innumerable textbooks and horn books, and even on the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. Despite all this history, and despite so much recent painful experience, we have yet to develop a systematic effort to identify and uproot regulatory capture. That is a task long overdue. At the intersection of criminal law and administrative regulation, there are thus times when an independent prosecutor may be the only official capable of acting for the public, where cowed or compromised regulators fear to tread. Let's look at one area we can rip from the headlines: campaign finance. Last year, I held a hearing in my Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism on the failure of enforcement, both regulatory and criminal. Here's an actual fact pattern. A supposedly independent super PAC supports only one candidate. The super PAC was founded by that candidate's former campaign lawyer. It employs the same consulting company the campaign uses. That consulting company's founder is a former strategist for the campaign and is married to a current campaign advisor. That is an actual fact pattern, and we are to believe that this super PAC is independent. In the Federal Election Campaign Act, Congress defined independent expenditures as ones not made in concert or cooperation with or at the request or suggestion of such candidate, the candidate's authorized political committee, or their agents, or a political party committee, or its agents. Larry Noble, a witness at my hearing, who is the president of Americans for Campaign Reform and former general counsel at the FEC, said, "The FEC narrowed the coordination rules over time to the point where they were seen as totally ineffective. Indeed, they are narrowed to the point where candidates now customarily post footage so that super PACs supporting them can incorporate their footage directly into the super PAC's ads." Maithili Raman, the acting assistant attorney general for the criminal division, looked at the regulatory failure at the FEC, including, by the way, the case of a super PAC run by a candidate's mother, and concluded, "As a result, it will be rare that the evidence could give rise to proof beyond a reasonable doubt of criminal intent to illegally coordinate through contribution to or expenditures by a super PAC." So there you have a senior federal law enforcement official stating that the actions and inactions of the FEC on coordination have hampered criminal enforcement. regulations pertaining to disclosure are no better. The Federal Election Campaign Act states that groups making independent expenditures must disclose each person who has made a contribution in excess of $200 made for the purpose of independent expenditure. That seems pretty straightforward. Yet Republican commissioners at the FEC have said that the disclosure law only applies when the donor explicitly gives to fund a specific advertisement. For the sake of real disclosure, a clear federal statute prohibits giving a contribution, quote, in the name of another. Yet, in the 2012 elections, we saw blatant use of shell corporations to conceal multi-million dollar contributions to super PACs, and the FEC unwilling to even investigate. One shell company appeared, contributed $5 million to a super PAC supporting a presidential candidate, and then dissolved shortly thereafter. Now, there is one type of organization that need not disclose its donors. That's the 501c4 social welfare group. So, organizations wanting to hide their donors covet this status. But there's a rub. Section 501c4 of the Internal Revenue Code is for, quote, civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit but operated exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. IRS regulations make clear that spending money to intervene or participate in political campaigns does not constitute promotion of social welfare. But Treasury has allowed these organizations to spend money in campaigns as long as that's not their primary activity. The dark money groups have taken this to mean that 49% of their spending can be on independent expenditures, and the other 51% can be on a combination of issue ads, which are thinly veiled political attack ads, and transfers to other organizations that then spend money on political ads. So drill down, and you find that groups often state in those IRS filings, under penalty of perjury, that they are spending no money on elections. And those same groups also report, under penalty of perjury, millions of dollars in election spending to the Federal Election Commission. Let me be very exact about this. The IRS application form for 501c4 status includes question 15. Has the organization spent, or does it plan to spend, any money attempting to influence the selection, nomination, election, or appointment of any person to any federal, state, or local public office, or to an office in a political organization? And if that weren't enough, the Form 990 tax return asks, did the organization engage in direct or indirect political campaign activities on behalf of or in opposition to candidates for public office? Organizations answered no to these questions and then spent millions. One appears to have contributed over $33 million to other affiliated groups explicitly for the purpose of spending in elections. That brings us to the Department of Justice. It is a federal crime under 18 U.S. Code Section 1001 to make a material false statement on federal filings like these. It's also a federal crime under 26 U.S.C. 7206 to make a material false statement on the IRS form. Yet, no groups, none, have been referred by the IRS to the Department of Justice for investigation or prosecution. Now, in complex or arcane areas deep within the agency's specialized field of expertise, okay, DOJ could reasonably defer, even if it looked a bit smelly. But this is about lying, a simple and regrettably common human activity. The False Statements Law, 18 U.S.C. Section 1001, is a statute of general application. I used it regularly as U.S. Attorney. Assistant Attorney General Rahman acknowledged at my subcommittee hearing that false statement cases are what she called bread and butter cases for the Department of Justice. Yet every indication is that there has not even been an FBI or grand jury investigation into the question of lying. Perhaps there is a legitimate explanation of how an entity that declares under oath millions of dollars in election spending could answer no under oath to the question, has the organization spent or does it plan to spend any money attempting to influence this election, nomination, election, or appointment of any person? But such a plain, open, and notorious apparent falsehood should at least merit a question or two, or maybe a look at some records. If there's a good explanation, everybody can go home. If not, well, lying like that is a crime. I suspect that the hot potato rule was behind this multiple agency failure of administrative regulation and criminal enforcement. The forces behind this dark money flood are indeed immensely powerful, immensely intimidating. With responsibility shared among three agencies, each was likely happy to leave to the other two responsibility for acting and keep itself out of harm's way. The result of this triple failure has been a sickening failure of American democracy that we all witness around us, what one Kentucky newspaper pungently described as the tsunami of slime. Disclosure of who's behind political spending is the law of the land. Even that grotesque Citizens United decision recognized the importance of disclosure to proper citizenship. To their credit, Treasury and the IRS have at last proposed new rules to clean up this mess by clarifying the limitations on political spending by 501c4 groups. In comments submitted with 15 other senators, we wrote that these new IRS regulations must put an end to the use of 501c4 status as a means of evading campaign finance disclosure requirements. But the potato is hot indeed, as the headlines show. But Treasury, the IRS, and DOJ could have prevented untold self-inflicted damage to their credibility, as well as years of lawless, undisclosed spending, the tsunami of slime, if they'd acted sooner, as many had urged. They are now in a public firestorm anyway, so avoiding the hot potato didn't turn out to be such a great strategy. I think these examples from the campaign finance context illustrate three things. One, the importance of getting regulations right. Two, the importance of creating a responsive enforcement regime. And three, the importance of independent prosecutors who are willing to step in when timorous regulators, buffaloed by forces they are supposed to regulate, fear to do their jobs. Regulatory capture often comes through revolving doors with industry, or through favors and perquisites from industry, or through encroachment of the regulated industry into the regulatory agency, but it can also come from plain old fear, from the regulated industry hectoring and bullying and pillorying the regulator. Whatever the method of its capture, a captured regulator fails the public it was sworn to serve. A second lesson is that where criminal enforcement provides a backstop to protect the public, it too can fail, either because the prosecutor feels the area is so complex that it is best left to the agency's expert determination for good or ill, or because the potato was just too damned hot. Thank you for hearing me out. Do I take a question or two? I think that was what my program said. On the other hand, I'm also between you and the end of several hours of discussion of regulatory law, so I don't want to overburden my welcome here. Sir. Whoever wrote the statute back in 1954. But whose language was it? I do not know. But they did make clear, for the purposes of this illustration, they did make clear that what it does not mean is participating in political funding activities, because that would have allowed it to creep over into campaign finance, since this disclosure is a high enough value that 8 out of 9 Supreme Court justices agree that it's important. That's a value that I think the regulatory agency back in the day was wise to carve out. But under the pressure of all the money and all the politics, they went back from exclusively to primarily, and from primarily to 49%, and from 49% to, oh, and by the way, you can give the 51% to somebody else who can use 49% of it. So it all fell apart into the disarray that we now see. And it's frankly, it's not just a disgrace, it's a scandal. Yes? I'll say two things. One, we are so primitive in terms of regulatory capture. There is no office of government in the entire great United States government that has as its task explicitly the job to identify signs of regulatory capture. And there probably are metrics you could look at if you looked at policies of socializing with the regulated industry, if you looked at some of the revolving doors that were flowing, I think that there's a way you could develop metrics that made sense. We haven't even tried. We haven't even begun to embark on it. Administrative law hornbooks write about it. Economics treatises are written about it. Nobel Prize winners discuss it. Presidents talk about it. And yet, like the weather, nobody does anything about it. So we got a long way to go on the regulatory capture front before we're really even in the game or even on the field. I do think that where there are agreements between agencies, they can be very unhelpful. The reason that the federal prosecutors wouldn't look seriously at these, what appear to be blatant falsehoods on the 501c4 applications, is because they have developed a policy with the IRS that they won't investigate anything unless there's been an IRS referral. And the last thing that the IRS wanted to do was to refer this. They just wished it would go away, I think. And obviously, that wasn't a very successful strategy. But that was an unfortunate use of the memorandum of understanding between DOJ and IRS, particularly where it comes to an area where you don't have real agency expertise into which a prosecutor is intruding who does not have that really developed expertise. This is about lying. Every prosecutor knows how to make that case. That should not have been a standard. Similarly, I think some of the rules barring and allocating enforcement authority over sexual assault in the military were not helpful in terms of having DOJ just stay completely out of it and leaving that problem to military prosecutors, which for a long time was a very unfortunate situation and still a pretty bleak one. So those, you want to worry about those memorandum of understanding between agencies, because very often it's for the comfort of the two agencies and not for the best service of the public. Yes, ma'am. Well, if you can starve it completely, you don't need to worry so much about capturing it, I guess. I do think that the less independent expertise an agency is capable of building up, it then has two choices. It either has no expertise or it has to go to the industry for expertise. And if it goes to the industry for expertise, that expertise is probably not always going to be offered in a purely neutral and dispassionate, objective way. And so it does lean the institution more towards seeing the world from the worldview of the industry rather than the public. Yeah. It's kind of actually quaint to think about having a time when committee work mattered and ended up in legislation. That's kind of anomalous now with stuff being brought to the floor in packages and but it does happen. I think it varies. I suspect that ag and energy are the two committees that are most like a regulatory agency that have a specific industry kind of within their, you know, HELP covers a broad array of issues. It'd be hard to really pack it with so-called pro-industry folks. What industry? And I think some committees develop very good habits of oversight, armed services, intelligence, where you have big government establishments that need to be overseen and in turn regulated. So I haven't really seen that much in action. I think that the forces that are constraining us tend to be more tidal and societal forces. We will create a reaction if you try to put the words climate change into any piece of legislation. And there'll be every effort made to knock those terms out. But that doesn't reflect, I don't think, a particular committee in the Iron Triangle. That reflects this larger power that has had such an unfortunate influence on fair and honest and fact-based debate in Washington. And it actually relates back to this very topic because you'll notice that there was actually quite a lot of Republican activity on climate change until Citizens United was decided. And then 90% of the money was avalanched in from the right. And as many of my Republican friends are fond of pointing out to me, hey, there have been times when they've been spending more against us than they've been spending against you. The first step of the Citizens United flood of money was a purge in the Republican Party. And it was at that point that discussion of climate change became untenable. I mean, it was only 5 years ago that John McCain ran for president as a Republican nominee with a very strong platform on climate change. So there are bigger forces in play right now that bend Congress in strange directions than just this committee process that you discuss. I think it's an important concern, but now it's happening at a different scale. That's the clock. Okay. I'm being summoned. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.